Welcome to the Side Hustle Project, a podcast where we explore the nitty-gritty details behind what it takes to start and grow a profitable side hustle. I'm your host, Ryan Robinson, and in this podcast, I'm bringing you interviews with entrepreneurs, best-selling authors, CEOs, investors, and people just like you who are building and profiting from interesting side hustles. In today's episode, we're talking to Beate Chalette, the entrepreneur, consultant, and speaker behind The Growth Architect, a training program that's landed her on Huffington Post's list of the 50 must-follow women entrepreneurs of the year. As the author of the international best-selling book Happy Woman, Happy World, Beate focuses much of her work on helping women-led businesses and entrepreneurs to unlock their biggest challenges and reach true scale with their companies. Beate's personal story is an unbelievable one. Originally from Germany, she immigrated to the U.S. and eventually found herself in Los Angeles. Always an entrepreneur at heart, Beate took her interest in photography and parlayed that into growing her own stock photography business. However, at one point in time, she found herself $135,000 in debt as a single mother. But through a lot of hard work and creative problem solving, she went on to build a very powerful niche market for her stock photography business, and she sold that company to a Bill Gates-owned entertainment media brand. In this episode, Beate and I talk about how she cleverly navigated herself out of the depths from being significantly in debt as a single mother and entrepreneur. We dive into her experience writing several wildly successful books, including exactly what she did to turn one of them into an international bestseller. We cover how she books highly paid speaking gigs around the world, the tactics she's used to grow a large consulting business doing both in-person work and through scalable online courses. All of this and so much more. As always, you can find everything we mentioned in today's episode in the show notes at ryrob.com/podcast. That's spelled ryrob.com/podcast. Let's get into today's interview with Beate Chalette. Beate, welcome to the show.
I am pretty excited to be here, Ryan.
I'm excited to be talking to you. It's been a while since we last connected, back in my Creative Live days when you came through and did, I think, your first class there, actually.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm just blown away on how much you have done in the short amount of time.
Well, the same to you. You've been more than busy. But today we're talking about you. So I want to ask you, first of all, the question that I ask all of my guests right off the bat when they come here on the show. So, Beate, what book are you reading right now, or what's been your favorite recently?
Actually, I'm reading a book that's called Better Together, and that is a book that is about women leadership and what men can do to promote women leadership. And the book that's going to come right after that is The Board Game that Betsy Berkheimer Credere wrote, which is how women can get on board seats. So that's where my mind is at, women leadership.
I love it. I love it. Now, I love that you also have this kind of a lineup of what you know you're going to read next already. That seems uncommon to me.
Action items. It's all about being clear what the step after the step is going to be, or at least have a direction.
Do you have a big stack on your desk right now?
It's more like two of them. Yes, there's two stacks of stuff on my desk as I'm looking at it right now. I'm already feeling bad about it. Actually, no, I don't at all.
So, Beate, I want to lay some groundwork for our listeners today, those that may not be as familiar with your story. So you actually have kind of a wild come-up story. At one point in time, you were over $100,000 in debt as a single mother, and you eventually go on to sell your entertainment media company to Bill Gates. That is a crazy transformation. So setting the stage with that, I do want to wind the clock back a little bit further even to give our listeners more context. So can you tell us who Beate was as a child and where you grew up?
So I grew up in Germany. And now I want you to imagine that I'm that cute little girl with the blonde locks in Lederhosen, and which I was because I grew up in Bavaria. And I was always a little bit on the unruly side. So I didn't stay in the lines. I always had big ideas. I, you know, was very pro people. You know, I always came up with, you know, another way to look at things. So I wasn't really the best in school. I kind of made it through, but you know, I'm the kid where you would say, this could go either way.
I love that. What did your parents do when you were growing up?
So my mother was a typical housewife, a mother of three children that, you know, cleaned, cooked, did the laundry, and, you know, did sort of all the duties moms do. And my dad was a CEO, back then they called it a manager, of a dairy company in Nuremberg, which is, you know, I'm born in Munich and I grew up in Nuremberg.
Two very full-time jobs there.
Absolutely.
And you also have a background in photography as well, right? When did that sort of enter your life?
Well, that was when the aptitude test that I took when I was 16 in Germany told me that because I liked being outside and because I wasn't afraid of heights and because I wasn't afraid to, you know, do physical work, that I should have been a roofer. And Ryan, because I really didn't want to be a roofer. Yeah, because I didn't really want to be a roofer. Not that there's anything wrong with roofing, but I didn't want to be a roofer. So I decided that I was going to wanting to do something creative. And that's how I became a photographer, who, by the way, is outside a lot, schleps a lot of stuff. And it's, you know, quite physical.
Yeah, I do get the parallels between roofer, but definitely not quite the same.
No, absolutely not. So, you know, that, but that's when I figured out that the mold didn't fit and I had to figure out what my own path was.
Yeah. Yeah. And so with photography, did you sort of pursue an education in that?
I actually have a photography degree. So in my entire life, you know, that's really the only degree I have, which is a degree in photography.
Wow. I love that. That's awesome. And I know you put it into professional practice as well. So can you tell us about some of those early jobs that you had working?
Absolutely. So I was a photographer assistant. Then I was an event photographer. Then I became photo editor at Elle magazine in Germany because I happened to really like the business side of it. So I understood very early on that I was just much more interested in the business, but I liked creativity. So, you know, the business side of creativity was really what excited me. And then I immigrated to the United States. I became a artist representative here in Los Angeles. And first I started with hair, makeup, and stylists. And then I founded a photographer representation division for this company. And I got laid off just after my baby was born. And then I set up my first company that was a photographer representation business and a still photography production company.
Jeez, that's a lot. That was a very, very quick transition there. So, and I'm assuming this actually brings us up to the point in time that I mentioned at the beginning when you were a new single mother, you were starting to get in debt. Was most of your debt acquired from the founding of this business venture?
No, I kind of, you know, when I set up my business, it was the school of hard knocks, right? I went ahead a little bit and fell behind a little bit, went ahead a little bit, fell behind a little bit. But the real problem with the debt came when I found out that the key employee, you know, at this time we were about running $1 million in revenue, which is, you know, in the top 3% of all small businesses that ever make it to $1 million in revenue. And my key employee had this brilliant idea for her own business, which was in essence my business without me with my key vendor. And I know it's like, you know, like my life is kind of Ryan, like the story. It's like when everybody always says, oh yeah, you know, that happens to other people. But I'm actually the person this all happened to. It's just insane. And so I sued them because, you know, I'm German, so we have to be right about everything. At least at the time I had to. And next thing I'm like in this big lawsuit. And that's the first time I went into crazy debt. And then this lawsuit, you know, brought me like really down to my knees. But I had, remember, at that time I had set up a still photography production business and I had $500,000 of production volume on the book. So I thought it was going to be okay. And then September 11th came and in one day it wiped out my production business. I mean, literally my production business was over in 24 hours while I'm going through this lawsuit and, you know, and I'm thinking that's it. And then the lawsuit settles and I walk out with zero, but I had this other idea for the stock photography syndication. And that's the business that I eventually sold, that I now had to start with zero again. And that's when I accumulated this debt because I had this brilliant idea. And, you know, I was able to secure the best photographers because, you know, I mean, I was a photo editor. I mean, you know, I have a degree. I understand this, you know, really, really, really well. But I'm running a staircase up as fast as I can, and I just don't have any money. And that's how I ended up $135,000 in debt and very, very close to bankruptcy. Actually, I kind of was there.
Oh my God. So what comes next for you at that point in time? Obviously, you don't go into bankruptcy, as you said. So what did you do? How did you turn something like that around? Because I can imagine that's a very sort of mentally overwhelming place to be in as well.
Yes. I mean, mentally, this was, you know, this whole thing, you know, it went on over like a period of 10 years where stuff just kept happening and these like really big things happened. You know, I got, you know, thrown out of my house. My father died of pancreatic cancer in the meantime. I mean, it just, you know, these like really life-changing things kept happening. And there are a couple of things happened, Ryan. Number one, I sat down and I said to myself, this is just not normal that this happens to one person. So at the end of this, something must come out of it that other people have to be able to benefit from, because otherwise it would just be insanity, you know, just put so much negativity and so much hardship on one single person. The second thing I thought about is like, I will not drown in a puddle. So drowning in a puddle is just embarrassing. So if I was going to drown, right, then at least I was going to drown in the ocean, or it was a flaming inferno, not a match, because at least then it's worth it. So another thing I focus on, you know, and this is probably for a lot of your listeners relevant, is when you have something really difficult that you're facing, you cannot focus on this without end, because then you're circling around the same problem over and over and over again, and it most likely cannot be solved. So for example, I was already in debt. I was $135,000 in debt. So I limited the amount of time I worried about money because I already knew I didn't have any. So twice a month when I had to pay bills, that's the only time I actually worried about money. So it really was, you know, from the mental side of things, like you give yourself permission to go into these deep, dark despair moments where, you know, it's like this, oh shit moment. It's like, it's coming crashing down. I cannot do this. This is overwhelming. No way this is going to work. And then you stop because that's not going to help you anything. And then you go and shift to what can I do now? And, you know, and what I did is I wrote a letter to the president of the United States. Why not? You know, and to my rather large surprise is I did get a letter from the White House, and it said that the president was delighted to hear from me, which is kind of shocking because I'm sure he hasn't, you know, and that was George W. Bush back then. I'm sure he had no clue who I was, but you know, that's just kind of like in this process of when you send a letter to the White House, so they do answer it eventually, and they try to find a solution to help you. And so they put me in touch with the Small Business Administration. And now when a letter from the White House goes to the Small Business Administration, it doesn't go to Joe Schmo, the intern. It goes to the Deputy Chief Director. And so I'm walking into the SBA with my business plan. And I did write that business plan completely
so
prepared.
Did the work.
I did the work talking to the Deputy Chief Director of the SBA. Bam, there you go. And then Lorenzo Flores said to me, I'll put in what you put in. And within 3 months, they found me a bank that was willing to restructure this crazy amount of debt that I was in, which I had not defaulted on. I just, you know, borrowed more money to pay interest on borrowed money, but I hadn't defaulted on anything. I was never late on anything, which is a miracle in itself. And then they restructured my debt after the SBA helped me to, you know, to rewrite, you know, the financial portions of my business plan. And by the way, for anybody who's listening to this, nobody cares about, you know, all your great ideas. The first thing they do is go to the numbers and I want to see if the numbers work. So spend the most time on the numbers and just a little bit time explaining the idea, because the numbers are really doing the talking. And then they found me that bank and it freed up my line of credit. 3 months later, I'm profitable. And 18 months later, a Bill Gates company comes knocking and says, tell us how you did it.
Wow. That is ridiculous. I'm kind of at a loss for words here personally. I mean, over the span of 18 months, you make that kind of a crazy transition, right? So what is happening between in this period where, okay, so you've gotten to profitability, right? So you've gotten your feet back under you and you're growing your business. What are the main things that are helping you get to this point where you're attracting attention from one of the companies that Bill Gates is involved with? How do you do something like that?
Audacity. Literally, it is that I believe that when we, you know, when we're building something, you have to figure out what could it be and what's the potential of this business. And I remember when I got my first big contract, which was instrumental to my, you know, selling my business, because, you know, and Getty Images is the industry leader in the stock photography world, and they would not give me a meeting because it was a little nothing. And nobody knew about me, but I had figured out something very early on that all the men go to the bar at these conferences and the women don't. So I made a point to go to the bar, and there they all are. And so here you are, you know, you look your very best. Like, you know, you follow my Cinderella rule. That my Cinderella rule goes 3 drink maximum, in bed before midnight, you walk to your room alone. So, and that kept me out of, you know, kept me out of trouble and gained me a lot of respect. And suddenly they got to know me on a personal level and they found out I'm a pretty cool person. And they said, hey, why don't you come tomorrow and let's have a meeting? And so I'm sitting in front of Getty, the largest company. And at that time, I think they were making close to $1 billion in sales. And they said to me, well, but how many images do you have? And I said, well, I have like 400, which is like nothing, right? Other agencies have like millions and millions and millions. I had 400. And they said, well, but why would we take somebody on who has only such a small amount of images? And here comes the audacity thing. You have to make it a benefit. So I said, well, the reason that works for you is because I will build this database based upon your feedback on what sells. So I give you most of what you know will sell. So I'm not going to feed your database with all this junk, these millions of images that nobody ever even looks at. I'm going to give you less, but I'm going to target it exactly to what you can sell. I got the contract. You know, it's really audacity of looking at how can you turn the obstacle into a benefit for them. That's how I did it.
I love that. That's, I mean, that comes down to framing, right?
Always framing. Absolutely.
And here I am. I thought you were going to say you just sent a letter to Bill Gates. That was a way better story.
Well, you know, it was that my name just kept coming up at that time. And And it was the stars aligned. So a friend of mine, you know, there had been a buying frenzy. You know, Getty and Corbis went head to head and they bought everything and then it just stopped and nobody sold anything. And then there was a moment in time where a window opened and there was another player that got on the market and another buying frenzy began. And my friend who owned a food stock photography business, who actually mentored me, he sold his business for like some crazy $70 million. And then he looked at me and he says, you're next. And I'm like, ha ha, funny, funny, funny. But I had such a specialty product because I dealt with celebrity homes, which was a byproduct of what I was doing. And I didn't really build my business plan on that. It just happened that that thing sold the best. And thank God I had a controller who slapped the numbers in my face, locked me into my room, sat down, smacked the report in front of me and says, I will not get up until you actually look at the numbers. I look at the numbers. I'm going like, holy crap, I'm selling so much more of this than that. She says, well, can we please pay some attention to that now? And that's what I took the data, you know, so in the teaching point, the numbers, you got to know the numbers. Mm-hmm. And then I took the numbers and I really built up that business. And there it was, Bill Gates' company that owned Corbis, the largest and most prestigious celebrity syndication in the world, and they couldn't figure out how to grow it. And guess how they wanted to grow it? With celebrity homes. And I was the world leader. I at that time sold in 97 countries. And, I sold, Madonna's house like 36 times. And, I had Francis Ford Coppola, Julian Moore, Simon Baker. I mean, it was insane. And so they said, tell us how you do it. And I said, I'm not going to. You want to know how I do it? You buy it. And they did.
Audacity.
I love that.
So Beate, after selling your company, you eventually get your way up to, we're going to go to the year 2013 now. You release a book that goes on to become an international bestseller. It's called Happy Woman, Happy World. So for our listeners here today, what was the topic of this book, and why did you really feel so compelled to write it?
I love that question. Well, because I figured that women like me, we always told that it's not possible, or that we, that men don't really like women like us, or that we are bad mothers, or that we really can't have a career and a family, or that we, jeopardize our children's well-being if we go after our career, or that we, it's like 10,000 things. Are we too boisterous or too loud or have too much audacity? Or, it's like this bucket of all these things, and they're all really not very nice. And then I looked at it and I said, I can hardly be the only single mom, working mom, entrepreneur, immigrant with no family support who is going through this. Why is the information on how to do it not being shared? I looked around and I couldn't find anything. And so I wanted to write a book where I told women that are in this position where they are working moms or working entrepreneurs to tell them, this is how you can do it. And in essence, I developed a proprietary concept. It's called Egorhythm. And it says, life is like a loaf of bread. If you want to eat it all at once, you're going to get, at the very least, heartburn, or you choke. Or you cut it into slices and you have one slice at a time. What if our life was like that, one slice at a time? What if I could teach you? And that's what I do in the book. I show exactly how, what egorhythm a woman is in, and how to set that main focus, and how to really understand on how to maximize each of those egorhythms, because there's going to be another one after that. So instead of now trying to make all nine work at the same time, I show exactly what to do to enjoy each one at its fullest. Very simple.
And you know what I like most about what you just explored here? So first of all, I think the topic is fantastic. It's obviously driven by a clear need for a very specific kind of person too, which, to me, for a future authors out there, that's kind of the makings of a great audience and topic fit. But even more than that, your method of delivery makes it even more compelling, because you're breaking it up into, as you said, the slices versus trying to consume the full loaf and do something about it.
Exactly. And really, this is, I think, what we are looking at is, and you're in the space, it's about just keep it real. Just keep it real. I've done it. So you have two choices. If you want to do it, you're either going to try to figure this out on your own, and you're probably going to have some of the same obstacles and trials and tribulations, or you're going to look at people who've done it, and you're going to read what they have to say, and then you map out your path based upon information that's already exists. Because most of the stuff out there, and I know this is shocking to a lot of millennials especially, has already been done before. People already had that problem before. People already had to struggle to overcome it. So sometimes it's okay if you take what's out there and you read it, and then you decide on whether or not that applies to you. But at least you have the information.
Yeah, I would second that. So Beate, we also have a lot of aspiring authors, as I said, here in our audience today. So do you remember back to launching this book, what your best selling channels were for it? So, how, in this, essentially, how did you get your book to become a bestseller?
So there's a couple of things. So I'm actually writing another book right now, and this time I'm doing it very different. So I think first it's clear, you have to have a clear strategy what you want to use the book for. I will tell you that without any doubt or question that you cannot get any serious speaking engagement or build your platform unless you have a book of some sort. And so I, you know, co-founded the publishing company, which was a huge mistake. And I, you know, published it with my partners. And then I put it out. I did participate in contests. So that's one of the things that I think are really, really helpful, is to look at all these publishers' contests for independent books. If you're writing an independent book, obviously, or, you know, if you're with a publisher, there's all kinds of contests out there, because it makes it an award-winning book. So to date, we have won 3 awards for this book, for the simple reason that I kept submitting it to these contests. Excuse me. And then I hired somebody who was doing bestseller campaigns specifically for Amazon, because to me, you know, in this first book, it was important to me to set the stage and to have a book that I could, you know, reprint easily myself, which you kind of can't do as easily or cheaply when you have a big publisher, because the publisher wants pennies on everything that you do. So if you negotiate a publishing deal, make sure that you get the rights to buy copies of your own book for very cheap, because you might be wanting to use them at an event or send them as business cards to, you know, to people. So for example, I had Oracle connect with me about a potential speaking opportunity, so I can send them my book. That certainly beats sending them, you know, it has much higher value versus just a proposal, but you can say, hey, here is something for you. You personalize it. So that was a strategy I had for the first book. So have a strategy clear. The second book, I hired a book strategist, somebody who does 6-figure advances with the major 7 publishing houses, because my next book needs to be a much different, higher level book that now will establish me as a 5-figure speaker and really take my business to the next level. So it depends on what kind of strategy you want. And that way you're not surprised when it happens like that, you're actually clear that you mapped out that path to get there. Does this make sense? Is this helpful?
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's great. I like that a lot. And, you know, we're getting close to the end of our interview here. So I do want to shift gears real quick. Today, you're a little more focused largely on doing the speaking events, as you said, coaching, consulting engagements. So primarily, we're talking here to entrepreneurs who have an existing business, but feel somewhat stuck without truly scalable growth on the near horizon. So what's usually the first step you take with new consulting clients who you're going in and helping out? How do you turn their business around?
So it always starts without fail with the same thing, is people are unclear what their business actually is, or it's in their head, but when they try to talk about it, it comes out in like a blob. So it's not clearly defined, or it becomes an egomaniac idea. So people say, well, I do this, I do this, I do this, I do this, I do this. And by the time, you know, they're done talking, I'm asleep, because they only talked about themselves. So the first thing that I do is I teach my clients to understand how what they do actually helps their clients, and we build the language around how to get that across in sort of a sassy, fast, clearly to understand way that sounds completely unique. So it's distinguishable from everybody else. That's probably my greatest gift, is to take somebody, you know, I listen to them, I look at what they're saying, and then in my head, the model already forms. You've got to have a good business model. Most people don't have a business model. They have an idea, but no business model. So you got to figure out what the business model is and put some very strong communication. And I know in your writing, you know, it's everything. How do you talk about it?
I love that. It's a great foundation that kind of sets you up for growing from there.
Absolutely. Because then it's easy to say, okay, so now with that in mind, what do we need to sell them? And what are they going to respond to? What does this client need? And then you build packages. And then, you know, and then from there, you decide what's the authority platform that you're going to be building from there. That's when the book comes in. Don't write the book unless you have the first two pieces in place, because the book's not going to help you build a platform unless you have something to build a platform on. You know, I mean, you can't build a platform on water. You have to build it on, you know, on a foundation that's actually poured. And then we talk about leadership and growth strategies.
I love it. Well, Beate, I want to transition over to a couple of my frequently asked questions. I designed them to be intentionally short on my end here, but your responses do not need to be equally so.
Go ahead.
What is your number one piece of advice to someone listening today that wants to take their side hustle and turn it into a full-time business?
It's darkest before dawn. When it looks like it's not going to work and you're ready to give up, you're about an inch away from it.
Do you have any particular strategies, tactics, ideas that you've tested, ones that come to mind at least, that ended up being a failure?
Yeah, like running an ebook business for photography books. The reason why there are no ebooks for photography books, because it really doesn't work, but I thought I could change the whole world. That was an expensive failure. Oh, in an app business. I did get in the app business. That was very, very, very bad.
Why didn't that one pan out?
Because I couldn't, I didn't understand the language of programming, and I couldn't translate my ideas into language that the programmers understood. And programmers often can be passive aggressive or outward aggressive, because if you don't tell them, they're not going to do it, because they're not there to help you. They're only there to program what you tell them to. So if you don't know what you tell them to program, they're just not going to do it. Even if they knew how to do it, they just don't.
Yeah, that's kind of the difference of hiring a contractor versus bringing in a business partner who has a stake in it.
Absolutely. Huge. Yeah, huge. Those are my two recent expensive failures, yes.
Okay, well, this is going to be my last question for you. What's been the best investment you feel you've ever made in the context of growing your business? And this could be in the form of time, money, tools, product, services, education, or otherwise.
Probably all the time and energy I spent in self-development and learning. You know, sometimes you know, it gets a little bit too much with all the conferences and the digital marketing this and the that, and you get all caught in the learning frenzy. But I found that if you understand enough to tell if people you're working with are doing a good or a bad job, that's oftentimes just enough that you need to know. And it gives you a much broader spectrum to work from. So what I mean by that is I, for example, went and spoke for free at a research conference, only to find out that there was like the wrong audience for me for you know, potential clients for me. So I paid my fare. I went there, I spoke for free. I thought I got nothing out of it. But now I am working on a sponsorship model that I, you know, mentioned to you as we're prepping for this interview, is that I understand enough about some of the language in the survey, because, you know, the time I couldn't meet potential clients there, I spent actually talking to the exhibitors, and I learned enough about how surveys are done or how many kind of different survey companies are out there and what they're looking for, that I was able to now, as it comes to, you know, adding the survey part of my sponsorship idea, I can talk about it intelligently. So back then I thought I wasted time and money. Today I know I didn't.
Yeah. And I mean, invest in yourself, right? And you're walking away with basically a new business model because of that.
Exactly. And at least the confidence to talk about it somewhat intelligently.
All right. Well, Beate, thank you for joining us. Can you tell everyone listening today where they can go to learn more about you and everything else you're up to?
Absolutely. So you can find me at beatechalette.com, and that's BEATECHELETTE. And I actually invite everybody who wants, send me an email to my initial bc@beatechalette.com, and I'll send you a link to pick up some free gifts. Let's see who takes me up on that. There, it's not necessarily the early bird gets the worm, but the one who does the work and follows up gets the worm.
You're brave. Your email address is now out there.
It is out there. Bring it on.
All right. Well, Beate, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode of The Side Hustle Project, I would love your support. Head on over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating. And as always, you can catch every episode of The Side Hustle Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.